And our special guest tonight, Lionel Fanthorpe, the greatest storyteller ever born. And we've got more great stories, so snuggle up wherever you may be. Lionel, so you ram into this mound of sand on your motorcycle. What happens to you?
Well, if you can imagine the sheer basic physics of it, the front wheel stops dead and the rest of the thing is still trying to move at 30 miles an hour. So I did a pretty good impersonation of a ballistic missile being thrown at a castle wall by Julius Caesar. And I can try hard not to exaggerate. I think I traveled a good 3-4 yards, unsuspended until I hit this big, and I was really lucky, I hit this big clump of bushes, got a few prickles and scratches off them, but it was a lot better than hitting something solid.
I got
my leathers on anyway.
Do you ride with a helmet?
Yeah, it's compulsory in the UK.
Good.
And what we used to wear when I was a young motorcyclist before the crash helmets became compulsory, we used to go to the what we call the Army and Navy stores where you could buy military and forces surplus goods, and we used to wear these leather flying helmets.
Why do I picture you on a motorcycle with a little passenger buggy next to it, wherever you go, just like they did in the war?
Yeah. Well, the big bike I've got, a big 1500 twin, I had a big Harley-Davidson Glide for years. I loved it. I've got to tell you just one story which will, I think, really appeal to our American listeners, just about my big Harley. There was a lady whose husband had died here in Cardiff, and one of her married daughters was married to an American, and they were very, very happy. He was doing great with his business, and they had domestic servants in the house to look after things for them. So they said to the widowed mum, "Why don't you come and spend your retirement with us in the USA, and we can really look after you. It'll be fabulous." And she had a 20-year retirement, very long, happy retirement, finally passed over. And the daughter who lived here in Cardiff went over to collect her mother's ashes after the funeral and the cremation, and brought her mum back and said that, well, she wanted to lay her beside her husband in the Cardiff Cemetery. And she said to me, while mother was in the USA with my sister and brother-in-law, she saw ever so many Harley Davidsons, and she loved them. She admired them. She thought they were beautiful works of art. Could you put her little casket with the ashes on the pillion and say a prayer for her before we lay her to rest? So I laid little casket of ashes, very solemnly and, with dignity, on the back of my Harley, and I said a prayer of committal into the hands of God, and then we laid her to rest. And her daughter, smiling through her tears, said, "Knowing my mother, she will now be telling St. Peter that she came to heaven on a Harley Davidson."
I love it. Up next, the Green Children of Woolpit. Tell us about this one.
Well, this is a story that came from a very reputable source, and it's always good to check the sources. There was a chronicler in the Middle Ages named Ralph, who was abbot of a Cistercian monastery at a little place in Suffolk called Coggeshall. And the name Woolpit, where these green children have appeared, is pretty interesting in itself, because nobody's quite sure where it came from. Some historians believe that it was a wolf pit, which had been dug to trap the wild wolves that ran around there in those days. Others think that it may have been named after the wool, which was the source of East Anglian prosperity in the 11th century. But in any case, Ralph got hold of this story, and there's an account preserved in the British Museum in the Harleian collection. And for any serious historians who are interested, it's manuscript number 3875. And translated from the Latin, here is roughly what it says. "Concerning the green children, it does not seem right or proper to leave out a miracle that occurred in King Stephen's reign in Anglia." And it goes on to say this. "There is an East Anglian village a few miles from the monastery of the blessed martyr King Edward, King Edmund. And close to this village, there are some ancient excavations, which are referred to as wolf pits. Now, at harvest time, while the harvesters were busy in the fields collecting their crops, two children appeared, one boy, one girl, with completely green bodies. They were also wearing clothing of a strange color, made from unusual material. And as these bewildered children wandered through the fields, the harvesters caught them, took them to the village. Many people gathered to see the strange sight. It was a long time before they would eat anything, although it was clear that they were almost fainting from hunger. Mm-hmm. Food was offered to them in plenty, but they would touch none of it. It was discovered by accident, while beans were being gathered in from the fields, that the children tried to eat the pith from inside the stalks. And they cried with great sadness because they couldn't find any. And then one of the harvesters took some pith from a pod and gave it to them. And they ate that eagerly. For some months they would eat nothing but that. Gradually they got used to bread, and their color slowly changed until it was like ours. They learned to speak our language and were baptized. The boy, who appeared to be the younger of the two, sadly died. But the girl, who was now indistinguishable from our own women, married a man from King's Lynn. And when they had mastered our speech, they were questioned about who they were, where they'd come from. They said they came from the land of St. Martin, a place where the saint was greatly venerated. They had no idea where their own land was, nor did they know how they had come to be in the field where they were found by the villagers. And so the tale goes on. It's pretty well authenticated that the two kids just turned up in the harvest field. They didn't really know where they were from. They didn't speak a recognizable language. They couldn't communicate with the kind-hearted villagers who looked after them. And eventually, as the boy had died, the girl had lost her green color and just become like any other sort of normal human young lady of her age, and married this guy from King's Lynn. Well, one of the things that I love about this story is that one of our Fanthorpe ancestors had a small business in King's Lynn, so that we've got King's Lynn ancestors. And I wonder whether remotely descended from this green girl who'd married the King's Lynn man. Maybe that accounts for my strange interest in mysteries.
You would think that these kids might have been extraterrestrial, huh?
Yes, you know, because he said the clothing was of an unusual material, and it is a possibility. If they had, shall we say, been the survivors of a ship that had crashed, or if they had been, you know, and we read so much of it in science fiction, and the avant-garde physicists are beginning to tell us that such things might really be possible, that you have matter-energy transmitters. Now, what if they had something rather like the beam me up, Mr. Scott, if they had stepped through the dimensions? There's so much in this amazing universe, and we're only just on the edge of real knowledge. Whether we're in one universe, when they get this new telescope going, you know, the one that was launched just a day or so ago?
With the fixing of the Hubble?
Yeah, this is the one. They're putting a new one up, which is hopefully going to be able to see much further than the Hubble could. And it's going to be an amazing thing. They're talking about the possibility of universes beyond what we think we have been able to explore. And the phrase multiverse comes up. Now,
yep.
What if these children were from somewhere like that, and not necessarily via a UFO, but what if they had been somehow kind of transmitted from one dimension to another, that these things could well be possible? And as I said, at the moment, we're just paddling on the edge of a huge ocean of knowledge in which we're going to discover so much more about additional dimensions and these probability tracks and alternate universes, matter and antimatter. It's all out there waiting to be discovered.
A question I've never asked you, I'm going to do it now.
Okay.
Where do you think this all came from?
I have to put on one or two different hats in succession.
Yes, absolutely.
If I put on my priest's hat and I do most honestly and sincerely believe in the existence of the benign and powerful and loving and creative God, then I think that somewhere at the very back of everything, this benign power, which Jesus taught us to call Father, so it's a personal power, it's not just a blind automatic force. I think that there is a great benign, creative, and sustaining force at the back of us, somewhere. I don't understand how it works. I don't understand whether it was there before the beginning or whether it was part of the beginning. I like to think as a priest that God was there before the beginning. And so that's my, as it were, theological answer. I think that there is a personal God who is caring and benign. It's very difficult indeed to explain terrible suffering and disaster and to maintain that belief. This problem of God versus human suffering is extremely difficult to answer, but I still believe through that. As the great Studdard Kennedy, who was a famous padre in World War I, mm-hmm. used to say to his suffering fellow soldiers in the trenches, "You'll still have doubts. I still have doubts, but I am able to live with them." And I take that from him as my own position. Now, if we're looking at things scientifically, I think we've got two things. We've got Fred Hoyle and the steady state theory, that the universe has always been here and that it renews itself as it appears to.
Which is a pretty good theory.
Yeah, I prefer that to the idea of a once-and-for-all Big Bang. I like to think that the steady-state theory has more going for it than this emergence from a single point. And yet, it is, I think, equally possible that the universe beats almost like a great heart, that mm-hmm. it expands and contracts. And so steady-state consists of expansion, contraction, expansion, contraction. And whatever else is out there, I believe, and I would go along, I was so interested in your very positive, I was quietly shouting, "Yes, George, you're right," your very positive attitude to the recovery from this ghastly economic global problem in which every nation's involved.
Yes.
And I love the way you said, it's going to be tough. It is tough, but we will come through. Now, I think that human minds, conscious thought, and intellectual processes can in some way, as yet to be explored and fully understood, I believe that they can influence the matter around us. I know that there are guys who are a lot younger than me who are hanging up their football kit or putting away their sports gear and saying, "Oh man, I'm 40, I've got to give up." I think this is ridiculous. You got to go on. So that the mental attitude, if you believe that there's a future, you're going on, that positive attitude, whether it's your example of it with coming through the financial crisis or whether it's a health issue, and healthy living, and you say, "I'm going to get over this. I'm going to be as fit and as strong as I've ever been, and I'm going to do all the things I ever did." That really can affect the body. And I think we can also affect the universe around us. I think part of our purpose, if I go back to my belief in God, is a creative, sustaining power. I believe that the purpose men and women like us is to think good and positive thoughts and to put those thoughts into action, to augment them, to supplement them by what we do. And that is the background answer. I think the steady state may be true. There may have been no beginning.
And no end.
And no end. No, we're going on. I love the piece that you were telling our listeners about going on to Mars, to colonize the universe. I think it's there for us to colonize. And I'd like to be one of the first guys to, you know, get to the Martian colony, take Patricia and the grandchildren and show them around and say, yes, this is our dome. Come for a holiday whenever you like, kids. We live here near the canals.
I love it. The Trail of the Devonshire Footprints. We've got some time for that.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to do that one with you now, George. This is the Devonshire Footprints began on the night of Wednesday, February the 7th, 1855. And there had been an abnormally heavy fall of snow. Devonshire's down in the southwest in the UK, and we don't normally get snow down there. But on the morning of Thursday, February the 8th, one of the bakers in a little village called Topsham came out of his bakery door and found a smooth white blanket of snow everywhere. And then he spotted a line of these very strange-looking footprints running from his yard's 6-foot wooden fence to the door of the bakery and back again. Well, he thought the trail had been made by a stray donkey or pony. And then as he studied it more closely, even though the little prints were donkey-shaped, they were one behind the other in an absolutely straight line, as if somebody had, yeah, it's weird, as if somebody had fastened a little donkey horseshoe to a wheel and pushed it along so that one followed the other.
Yeah.
But no donkey the baker had ever seen walked like that. And the more he thought about it, no animal walked like that. Bipeds like us can make single tracks, but even then, they're not in a dead straight line. Your left foot is to the left and your right foot is to the right. And you only make a dead straight line if you're trying to walk a tightrope. Now, Henry had to get on with his work in the bakery, and he couldn't spend more than a few minutes worrying about the marks in the snow. And then Al Brailford, who was the Topsham schoolmaster, turned up at the head of a small group of very excited villagers. They had followed the trail all the way to Henry's bakery yard. And it was, as far as they'd been able to tell, it was now all over the village. It was on the roads, it had gone across gardens, it was along paths, it went into yards, it went over the fields, and this was the thing that made it really strange. It went up to the wall of a house, and then it reappeared on the other side, as if the house hadn't been able to stop it and it simply risen in the air. It had gone up to fences that were up to 12 feet high, and then just carried on as if the fence wasn't there.
Jeez.
Now, this little group of footstep trackers got bigger and bigger as they attracted more and more people to come out and have a look. So there were housewives, young children, apprentices, tradesmen, shopkeepers, customers. Everyone stopped what he or she was doing and joined in the hunt. And the further they followed the trail, the more disconcerting it became. Because nothing physical ever proved to be an obstacle for it. And the tracks did not vary. Nor did they show any of sort of telltale signs as though they'd been left by an animal that had stopped to feed or to look around or to listen. And nowhere did that track seem to have crossed itself. It's just totally inexplicable. And it ran for over 100 miles, including crossing the estuary of the River X, which was a mile wide.
Another great story. Back with final stories in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we are going to talk about the Bermuda Triangle and then, of course, our Friday into Saturday morning special open lines. Up next, final stories, Campfire Stories with Lionel Fanthorpe, the author of Secrets of the World's Undiscovered Treasures. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Moving into our final segment now with Lionel Fanthorpe. Lionel, these nights go by so fast with you.
Oh, thank you, George. It's a great compliment. If I can return the compliment, it doesn't seem to me that I've been here for 2 hours and 40 minutes. I'm just getting started.
They're just breezing by, huh? got to have you on one night when we do a marathon show of 10 hours straight.
I'd love to do that.
You're the one for that. Time slips. Time slips in Norfolk. Tell me about this one.
Oh, no, the time slips. This goes back. We got, just as we had with the Green Children, we have some really good specific archive material on this, which makes the story so authentic. It gives it just that historical background that we need to make it interesting. And there was a guy called Ben Curtis who wrote this in a publication called The Archives of the North Folk, which was what they used to call Norfolk, where I came from. And this is from 1603. And this is what Ben Curtis wrote.
1603?
Yep.
Okay.
Archives of the North Folk, 1603, written by Ben Curtis. And he said this. In the great broad of Wroxham, now in Norfolk the broads are lakes. In the great broad of Wroxham, near unto Hoverton St. John, two friends and myself were swimming across the lake from the Bure side, the Bure is one of the rivers, from the Bure side to that opposite, when, strangely enough, we felt our feet touch the bottom. Now at this part of the lake, there is 12 feet of water. But we kept together and presently found ourselves standing in the middle of a large arena with seats one above the other all around us. The water had gone, and we were standing there dressed as Roman officers. And what was more astonishing still, we were not surprised, and neither were we incommoded by this piece of enchantment. These are Ben Curtis's words that I'm reading from 1603. But rather, we were quite accustomed to it, so that we forgot that we had been bathing. And the top of the amphitheatre was all open to the sky, and many flags of divers colours floated in the wind from the top of the walls. And then followed this lengthy, detailed account of a Roman pageant, which Ben and his two friends claim that they witnessed. And the story is repeated with one or two interesting variations in another account from 100 years or more later. This one was written by a priest, the Reverend Thomas Josiah Penston, and it was published in a magazine called the Gentleman's Gazette, April 16th, 1709. And this was what Father Penston wrote in the magazine. We were having a picnic on the banks of a beautiful lake in Norfolk, about 11 miles from the ancient city of Norwich, when we were suddenly ordered away by a very, and I love his phrasing here, a very undesirable-looking person. And we were somewhat enangered by this unpleasant person's persistence, and we made to go away. But suddenly we had to stand aside to make way for a long procession containing a golden chariot in which rode a man dressed as a Roman general. Then there were lions led in chains by stalwart Roman soldiers, a band of trumpeters making a great noise, and another band of drummers. They passed quite close to us, but no one apparently saw us. There must have been 700 or 800 in this procession. Where they went, or where they came from, I do not know, but they vanished at the side of the lake. And then we jump another 100 years, and it's from the private letters of Lord Percival Durand. He says that on the 21st of July in 1829, they were on board his yacht, the Amaryllis, and they were anchored about 200 yards from the eastern entrance to Wroxham Broad, which is the same lake that the other two accounts referred to.
Right.
And he said, we went ashore and were looking out across the broad. The day was a particularly hot one. And then an old man appeared, shriveled and worn, leaning on a stick. No one saw him arrive, and no one saw where he went afterwards. They asked him who he was, and he said, my name is Flavius Mantus. I am the Custos Rotulorum for this part of Britain. And he warned Durand and his guests that they were trespassing on land that belonged to the Western Emperor Marcus Aurelius Carausius. And Lord Percival then goes on to describe how, to his amazement, just as with Ben Curtis and his friends, the waters of the Broad seemed to roll back, and the strange old man was transformed into a splendidly uniformed Roman officer. Durand records that he and his friends saw a vast Roman amphitheater and a procession just like the ones the other witnesses had described.
Now,
there are three accounts there of this mysterious time slip. And again, we have to ask ourselves, don't we, that what is time? There's the possibility that we move through it, or that we are metaphorically standing still as it moves past us. And if we go on the theory that time is wound around like a ball of wool, where certain threads cross other threads, if you go all the way around the thread, it's 100 years or 1,000 years, but if you happen to be at the point where two threads cross, a guy from our century may see a Roman, or a caveman, or an ancient Egyptian, or anything at all, and maybe some of these strange sightings that we think of as extraterrestrials, could they possibly be men and women from the future, from, shall we say, 3,000 years ahead of us?
You never know.
Where their time thread has crossed ours. Yeah, we just don't know. I think that when you get good, honest witnesses like those three doing their accounts 100 years apart, there's a real mystery there. It's not just somebody thinking they've seen something. There was something that they saw.
I know we've talked about this before, but I would be remiss if I didn't have you talk about Springheel Jack.
Well, he's one of my favorites, so that's
I can listen to this story every time you're on.
Oh, thank you for that, George. Well, he's one of my all-time favorites, and I think, again, there's a little bit of psychology in this as well, because it's a story that my father told me, and I had that sort of interesting experience of having a father who was really generationally a grandfather, and so I got these old Victorian stories. My dad's first wife had died, and when he was in his 50s, they'd had 25 happy years together, and then he met and married my mother, who was only 19. And so when I was born, my dad was well into his 50s, and it was like being looked after, loved, and told stories by your grandfather.
You're right.
And he's the guy who told me all about Springheel Jack. Well, Dad was born in 1880, and when he was a youngster, Springheel Jack was very much on the go.
And did he tell you the story with the same passion that you have?
Oh, yes. I'd like to think, and I sort of say thank you to him up there. Hey, Dad, thank you for teaching me how to tell stories, because I learned from you. The Springheel Jack story was that this was in Victorian London back in the 19th century, and he seemed to have a desire, a kind of perverted desire to frighten young women, because 90% of his victims were young housewives or were young servant girls, when everybody had domestic servants then. And when they went to the door to answer the bell, which was part of their duty, Springheel Jack would attack them. And as soon as they screamed for help and the men of the house came running to get the guy, he would escape at high speed, not just by running, but by leaping. And just imagine that we're in one of these, say a London hotel, where we're on holiday, and one of the girls is going to the side door of the hotel thinking it's a tradesman making a delivery, and the next minute she's screaming for help. So you and me and two or three other guys go rushing to help the kid, as we would, and we say, that's him, that's the guy who attacked me. We go after him, he goes down this narrow lane, right, we've got him now, he's in the back lane. We got him cornered. And he jumps a 15-foot wall from a standing start, and all we can do is look in amazement.
With our mouths open.
With our mouths open, as he gives a cackling laugh and disappears. I mean, he even tried it down at Aldershot, which is, you know, a famous British military training establishment. And the sentry there was a good soldier, a professional soldier. And he had been taught, and he was a properly disciplined soldier of the 19th century, and such men took no nonsense. And if he gave the challenge of, halt, who goes there, and the bloke doesn't stop, he will fire. And these guys were good shots. And he gave his account to his commanding officer. He said this strange figure appeared, approached the sentry box, and he, as a good man, on duty, defending his comrades in the camp, halt, who goes there? The thing gave a cackling laugh and kept coming. And so, a good sentry fired. And he was certain that he'd hit him. But the only response was this cackling laugh, which was characteristic of Spring-Heeled Jack, and he leapt from a standing position right over the sentry box. Now, a sentry box is a good 7 or 8 feet high to make room for the man inside. So from a standing start to go higher in the air than the best Olympic high jump, you know, what was this thing? Just as we said when we talked about the Green Children, was he an extraterrestrial of some sort? And then we occasionally find, if we look at the things that mutation can do, there are people who have abnormal physical powers. You would find someone, should we say, has abnormal muscular strength, or somebody has remarkably good vision because of some minor mutation that's taken place. Is it possible that this had begun as a normal human child, but that it had this peculiar leg muscle development? I mean, it had to be 3, 4, 5 times as much. The guy could jump as high on Earth as an astronaut would be able to jump on the moon, which has only 1/6 of our gravity. Now, what if Jack was an extraterrestrial, a humanoid extraterrestrial, who had come from a planet on which the gravity was 4 or 5 or 6 times ours? That would enable him to do things which an Earthman could do on the moon.
He was mean, though, Lionel, wasn't he?
He was very mean. Yeah. There was something hideous about him. In the days when, Victorian times, there were an enormous number of teenage prostitutes in London, poor little kids. It was that or stuff.
This is during the Jack the Ripper era, wasn't
this
it?
This is the Jack the Ripper era, yes. And there have even been theories that the Ripper was somehow connected with Spring-Heeled Jack.
That's a good
there was
point.
Only one Jack, and it was the same man. It's an interesting theory, but the Ripper never seems to have demonstrated those same weird athletic powers that Spring-Heeled Jack demonstrated. And then with this poor little girl was in a part of London where there was a very deep, in those days, the hygiene was ghastly, especially in the East End. And she was going past what was merely a sort of an open sewage ditch. And Jack appeared, gives one of his hideous laughs, and throws her into the sewage where the poor kid drowned.
Ugh.
Absolutely foul. And on many of the occasions, he would frighten or injure girls. On one occasion, he was also apparently highly intelligent, because on one occasion he knocked on the door of a house, and when the little servant girl came to the door to answer as part of her duty, Jack pretended to be a policeman and said, come quickly, miss, bring a light, we've caught Spring-Heeled Jack. And of course, poor girl goes back, comes back with a candle, steps outside, and the entity that had been pretending to be a policeman was Spring-Heeled Jack, and he began to attack her. And the girls who had been attacked, as he normally ripped their clothing away, said that the hands didn't feel, and this again goes with our extraterrestrial theory maybe, said the hands didn't feel like human hands. They felt more like steel claws. Now, what was this thing? Was he, you know, was he some kind of creature? Was he something like a robot? What was he? And did he have these perhaps artificial limbs, which gave him extra strength. If we imagine that it was perhaps a biological body with powerful steel spring legs and steel arms, was it almost like an evil version of, hey, Oscar, we can rebuild him? Had somebody made a $6 million man?
Could have been. Could have been an inventor.
Yes, it could. It's just inexplicable, and there's much, much more to the story than can be explained in normal terms. There was some theories suggested that it was the Mad Marquess of Waterford, and that he, during his days at university, had been a remarkably good athlete and a boxer, but there was no evil in him. He was a joker and a prankster. Mm-hmm. But he would never have drowned the girl in the ditch, and he would never have attacked girls with these steel claws. That's another thing which Springheel Jack appeared to be able to do. A number of victims and witnesses said that he'd breathed blue fire into their faces as though he was a circus fire eater. He seemed to have have mastered a flaming breath technique. And so if he was, as he sometimes was, almost cornered, then he would blow this fire at the guys who were after him. And while they were getting back out of the range of that to keep it out of their eyes, then another of these great bounding leaps and he's gone over a 12-foot fence and that's it. Of course, another thought, because you'd asked for both stories on the same session, I'm wondering about those Devonshire footprints. That was 1855. I wonder if Jack had made his way from London down there, because that could account for the way that the maker of the Devonshire footprint trail could clear a 12-foot fence or could actually clear a house. Were those strange marks the artificial feet on the end of those steel spring legs that, had made him part flesh and blood, part machine?
If he had cloven feet, I would have thought he might have been the devil.
Well, this is what they thought down in the Devonshire footprint story. In fact, some of the local priests in their parish churches where the footprints had appeared actually preached sermons about the wickedness of people, saying it was the devil looking for you.
That is one of the great stories. Lionel, guess what? We're out of time.
Hey, can't be, but I believe you.
We're going to leave this campfire with some of the embers still burning, all right? And we shall move on. Lionel, thanks again, and keep in touch with us.
Of course we will, George. I love being on your show, and it's always a privilege to be a guest.
The greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe. His latest work, Secrets of the World's Undiscovered Treasures, and he's working on more. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.